Chapter 9. A Short Path. Tuan and Seleucia were not the only women who caused Matt trouble, of course. Sometimes it seemed that most of the trouble in his life came from women, which he could not understand at all, since he always tried to treat them well. Even Aginin gave her share of grief, though it was the smallest share.
"I was right. You do think you can marry her," she drawled when he asked her for help with Tuan.
She and Doman were seated on the steps of their wagon with their arms around each other. A trickle of smoke rose from Doman's pipe. It was mid-morning on a fine day, though gathering clouds threatened rain for later, and the performers were putting on their acts for the inhabitants of four small villages that combined perhaps equaled Runnian Crossing in size. Matt had no desire to go watch. Oh, he still enjoyed watching the contortionists, and better still the female acrobats and tumblers, but when you saw jugglers and fire-eaters and the like every day just about, even Majora and her leopards became, well, less interesting, if not exactly ordinary.
"Never you mind what I think, Aginin. Will you tell me what you know of her?
Trying to find out from her is like fishing blindfolded and barehanded in a briar patch trying to catch a rabbit."
"My name is Lyowin Cawthon. Don't forget it again," she said in tones suitable for giving orders on a ship's deck.
Her eyes tried to drive the command home like blue hammers.
"Why should I help you? You aim too high above yourself, a mole yearning for the sun. You could face execution for simply saying you want to marry her. It's disgusting. Besides, I've left all that behind me. Or it's left me," she added bitterly.
Doman gave her a one-armed hug.
"If you've left all that behind you, what do you care how disgusting my wanting to marry her is?"
There, it was out in the open. Partly, at least. Doman removed the pipe from his mouth long enough to blow a smoke ring aimed at Matt's face.
"If she does not want to help you, then give over."
He gave it that same ship's-deck voice of command. Aginin muttered under her breath. She appeared to be arguing with herself. Finally, she shook her head.
"No, Bale, he's right. If I'm cast adrift, then I have to find a new ship and a new course. I can never return to Seanchan, so I might as well cut the cable and be done with it."
What she knew of Tuan was mainly rumor. It seemed the Imperial family lived their lives behind walls even when in plain sight, and only whispers of what went on behind those walls escaped. Yet those were sufficient to make the hair on the back of Matt's neck stand up. His wife-to-be had had a brother and a sister assassinated? After they tried to have her killed, true, but still. What kind of family went around killing one another? The Seanchan blood and the Imperial family, for starters. Half of her siblings were dead, assassinated, most of them, and maybe the others, too. Some of what Aginin, Lyowin, had to tell was generally known among Seanchan, and hardly more comforting. Tuan would have been schooled in intrigue from infancy, schooled in weapons and fighting with her bare hands, heavily guarded yet expected to be her own last line of defense. All of those born to the blood were taught to dissemble, to disguise their intentions and ambitions. Power shifted constantly among the blood, some climbing higher, others slipping down, and the dance was only faster and more dangerous in the Imperial family. The Empress, she started to add, "May she live forever," and half choked in swallowing the words, then closed her eyes for a long moment before continuing. The Empress had borne many children, as every Empress did, so that among those who survived there would be one fit to rule after her. It would not do to have someone who was stupid or a fool ascend the crystal throne. Tuan was accounted very far from either. Light. The woman he was to marry was as bad as Warder and Aes Sedai wrapped into one, and maybe as dangerous. He had several conversations with Aginin. He was careful to name her Lyowin to her face, lest she go for him with her dagger. Yet he thought of her as Aginin, trying to learn more, but her knowledge of the blood was largely from the outside looking in, and her knowledge of the Imperial Court, by her own admission, little better than that of a street urchin in Shandar. The day he gave Tuan the mare, he had ridden alongside Aginin's wagon having one of those fruitless conversations. He had accompanied Tuan and Seleucia for a time, but they kept looking at him sideways, then exchanging glances and giggling. Over what they had told the Tinker women, without a sliver of doubt. A man could only take so much of that sort of thing.
"A clever gift, that mare,"
Aginin said, leaning out from the driver's seat to look up the line of wagons. Doman was handling the reins. She took her turn sometimes, but handling a team was not among the skills she had learned on ships.
"How did you know?"
"Know what?" he asked. She straightened and adjusted her wig. He did not know why she continued to wear the thing. Her own black hair was short, but no shorter than Seleucia's.
"About courting gifts. Among the blood, when you are courting someone higher than you, a traditional gift is something exotic or rare. Best of all is if you can connect the gift somehow to one of the recipient's pleasures, and it's well known the High Lady loves horses. It's good you've acknowledged that you don't expect to be her equal, too. Not that this is going to work, you understand. I don't have a clue why she's still here. Now you've stopped guarding her, but you can't believe she'll actually say the words. When she marries, it will be for the good of the Empire, not because some layabout like you gave her a horse or made her smile."
Matt ground his teeth to keep from shouting a curse. He had acknowledged what? No wonder a set of bloody dice had stopped. Tuan would let him forget this when it snowed on Sunday. He was certain sure of that. If Lylwyn bloody shipless gave him small griefs, the Aes Sedai managed larger. Aes Sedai liked nothing better. He was resigned to them traipsing about every village and town they stopped at, asking questions and doing the light knew what else. He had no choice but resignation, with no way to stop them. They claimed to be taking care. At least Teslin and Edesina did. Jolene snapped that he was a fool for worrying. Yet an Aes Sedai taking care was still clearly a woman of consequence, whether or not anybody recognized what she was. Lacking the coin for silks, they had purchased bolts of fine wool in Jurador, and the seamstresses worked as hard for Aes Sedai as they did for Matt's gold, so they strolled about dressed like wealthy merchants and as sure of themselves as any noble ever born. Nobody saw one of them walk 5 strides without knowing that she expected the world to conform itself to her. 3 women like that, with a traveling show at that, were sure to cause talk. At least Jolene left her great serpent ring in her belt pouch. The other two had lost theirs to the Seanchan. If Matt had seen Jolene with the thing actually on her finger, he thought he would have wept. He got no more reports on their activities from the former Suldam. Jolene had Bethamon firmly in hand. The tall, dark woman ran when Jolene said run and jumped when she said toad. Edesina was giving her lessons too, but Jolene considered Bethamon a personal project for some reason. She was never harsh, that Matt saw, not after the face-slapping, but you might have thought she was getting Bethamon ready to go to the tower, and Bethamon returned a sort of gratitude that made it clear her loyalties had shifted. As for Sita, the yellow-haired woman was so frightened of the sisters that she did not dare follow them any longer. She actually shivered when he suggested it. Strange as it seemed, Sita and Bethamon had been so accustomed to how Seanchan women who could channel saw themselves that they had really believed Aes Sedai could not be much different. They were dangerous when off the leash, yet dangerous dogs could be handled by someone who knew how, and they were experts with that particular sort of dangerous dog. Now they knew that Aes Sedai were not dogs of any kind. They were wolves. Sita would have found another place to sleep had that been possible, and he learned from Mistress Annan that the Seanchan woman put her hands over her eyes whenever Jolene or Edesina was teaching Bethamon in the wagon.
"I'm certain she can see the weaves," Satala said.
He would have said she sounded envious, except that he doubted she envied anyone.
"She's halfway to admitting it, or she wouldn't hide her eyes. Soon or late she'll come around and want to learn, too."
Maybe she did sound envious at that. He could have wished for Sita to come around soon rather than late. Another student would have left the Aes Sedai less time to trouble him. If the show was halted, he could hardly turn around without seeing Jolene or Edesina peering around the corner of a tent or wagon at him. Usually the fox head cooled on his chest. He could not prove they were actually channeling at him, yet he was certain of it. He was unsure which of them found the loophole in his protection that Adelais and Van Deen had, that something thrown with the power would hit him, but after that he could barely leave his tent without getting hit by a rock and later by other things, burning sparks like a shower from a forge fire, stinging sparks that made him leap and his hair try to stand on end. He was positive that Jolene was behind it. If for no other reason, he never saw her without Blerick and Fenn, or both, nearby for protection. And she smiled at him like a cat smiling at a mouse. He was planning how to get her alone, it was that or spend his time hiding from her, when she and Teslin got into a shouting match that cleared Edesina out of the whitewashed wagon almost as quickly as Bethamin and Sita. And those two ran out and stood gaping at the wagon. The yellow sister calmly went back to brushing her long black hair, lifting it up with one hand and sweeping the wooden hairbrush down it with the other. Seeing Matt, she smiled at him without ceasing the motions of her brush. The medallion went cold, and the shouting vanished, as though cut off by a knife. He never learned what was behind that power-woven shield. Teslin favored him somewhat, yet when he asked her, she gave him one of those looks and silence. It was Aes Sedai business and none of his. Whatever had gone on in there, though, the rocks stopped and the sparks. He tried thanking Teslin, but she was having none of it.
"When something be no to be spoken of, it be no to be spoken of," she told him firmly. "It would be well for you to learn that lesson if you are to be around sisters. And I think your life be tied to Aes Sedai now if it was no before."
Bloody thing for her to say. She never cracked her teeth about his Tirangriol, but the same could not be said of Jolene and Edesina, even after the argument. They tried to bully him into handing it over every single day, Edesina cornering him by herself, Jolene with her warders glowering over her shoulders at him. Tirangriol were rightfully the property of the White Tower. Tirangriol needed proper study, particularly one with the odd properties this one possessed. Tirangriol were potentially dangerous, too much so to be left in the hands of the uninitiated. Neither said especially a man's hands, but Jolene came close. He began to worry that the Green would have Blerick and Fenn simply take it from him. That pair still suspected he had been involved in what had happened to her, and the dark looks they gave him said they wanted any excuse to beat him like a drum.
"That would be stealing," Mistress Annan told him in a lecturing tone, gathering her cloak around her.
The sunlight was beginning to fade, and coolness already setting in. They were standing outside Tuon's wagon, and he was hoping to get inside in time to be fed. Noel and Olver were already inside. Setala was apparently off to visit the Aes Sedai, something she did frequently.
"Tower law is quite clear on that. There might be considerable discussion over whether it had to be given back to you. I rather think it would not be, in the end. But Jolene would face a fairly harsh penance for theft all the same."
"Maybe she'd think it worth a penance," he muttered. His stomach rumbled. The potted finches and creamed onions that Lopin had presented proudly for his midday meal had both turned out to be spoiling, to the tyrant's extreme mortification, which meant Matt had had a heel of bread since breakfast and no more. "You know an awful lot about the White Tower."
"What I know, Lord Matt, is that you've made just about every misstep a man can make with Aes Sedai, short of trying to kill one. The reason I came with you in the first place instead of going with my husband, half the reason I'm still here, is to try to keep you from making too many missteps. Truth to tell, I don't know why I should care, but I do, and that's that. If you had let yourself be guided by me, you'd not be in trouble with them now. I can't say how much I can recover for you, not now, but I am still willing to try."
Matt shook his head. There were only two ways to deal with Aes Sedai without getting burned: let them walk all over you or stay away from them. He would not do the first, and could not do the second. So he had to find a third way, and he doubted it could come from following Sitala's advice. Women's advice about Aes Sedai generally was to follow the first path, though they never worded it that way. They talked of accommodation. But it was never the Aes Sedai who was expected to do any accommodating.
"Half the reason. What's the other?"
He grunted as though he had been punched in the stomach.
"Tuon? You think I can't be trusted with Tuon?"
Mistress Annan laughed at him, a fine, rich laugh.
"You are a rogue, my lord. Now, some rogues make fine husbands once they've been tamed a little around the edges. My Jasper was a rogue when I met him. But you still think you can nibble a pastry here, nibble a pastry there, then dance off to the next."
"There's no dancing away from this one," Matt said, frowning up at the wagon door. The dice clicked away in his head. "Not for me." He was not sure he really wanted to dance away any more, but want and wish as he might, he was well and truly caught.
"Like that, is it?" she murmured. "Oh, you've chosen a fine one to break your heart."
"That's as may be, Mistress Annan, but I have my reasons. I'd better get inside before they eat everything." He turned toward the steps at the back of the wagon, and she laid a hand on his arm.
"Could I see it? Just to see?"
There was no doubt what she meant. He hesitated, then fished in the neck of his shirt for the leather cord that held the medallion. He could not have said why. He had refused Jolene and Edesina even a glimpse. It was a fine piece of work, a silver fox head nearly as big as his palm. Only one eye showed, and enough daylight remained to see, if you looked close, that the pupil was half-shaded to form the ancient symbol of Aes Sedai. Her hand trembled slightly as she traced a finger around that eye. She had said she only wanted to see it, but he allowed the touching. She breathed out a long sigh. "You were Aes Sedai once," he said quietly, and her hand froze. She recovered herself so quickly that he might have imagined it. She was stately Setala Annan, the innkeeper from Ebu Dar, with the big golden hoops in her ears and the marriage knife dangling hilt down into her round cleavage, about as far from an Aes Sedai as could be.
"The sisters think I'm lying about never having been to the tower. They think I was a servant there as a young woman, and listened where I shouldn't have."
"They haven't seen you looking at this." He bounced the fox head once on his hand before tucking it safely back under his shirt. She pretended not to care, and he pretended not to know she was pretending. Her lips twitched into a brief, rueful smile, as if she knew what he was thinking.
"The sisters would see it if they could let themselves," she said, as simply as if she were discussing the chances of rain. "But Aes Sedai expect that when certain things happen, the woman will go away decently and die soon after. I went away, but Jasper found me half-starved and sick on the streets of Ebu Dar, and took me to his mother."
She chuckled, just a woman telling how she met her husband.
"He used to take in stray kittens, too. Now you know some of my secrets, and I know some of yours. Shall we keep them to ourselves?"
"What secrets of mine do you know?" he demanded, instantly wary. Some of his secrets were dangerous to have known, and if too many knew of them, they were not really secrets anymore. Mistress Annan glanced at the wagon, frowning.
"That girl is playing a game with you as surely as you are playing one with her. Not the same game that you are. She's more like a general plotting a battle than a woman being courted. If she learns you're moonstruck with her, though, she'll still gain the advantage. I'm willing to let you have an even chance, or as near to one as any man has with a woman of any brains. Do we have an agreement?"
"We do," he replied fervently. "That we do." He would not have been surprised if the dice stopped then, but they went on bouncing. Had the sisters' fixation on his medallion been the only problem they gave him, had they contented themselves with creating rumors everywhere the show stopped, he could have said those days were no more than tolerably bad for traveling with Aes Sedai. Unfortunately, by the time the show departed Jurador, they had learned who Tuan was. Not that she was the daughter of the Nine Moons, but that she was a Shan Chan High Lady, someone of rank and influence.
"Do you take me for a fool?" Luca protested when Matt accused him of telling them.
He squared up beside his wagon, fists on his hips, a tall man full of indignation and ready to fight over it by his glare.
"That's a secret I want buried deep until—" Well, until she says I can use that warrant of protection. That won't be much use if she revokes it because I told something she wants hidden.
But his voice was a shade too earnest, and his eyes shifted a hair from meeting Matt's directly. The truth of it was, Luca liked to boast nearly as much as he liked gold. He must have thought it was safe, to tell the sisters, and only realized the snarl he had created after the words were out of his mouth. A snarl it was, as tangled as a pit full of snakes. The High Lady Tuon, readily at hand, presented an opportunity no Aes Sedai could have resisted. Teslin was every bit as bad as Jolene and Edesina. The three of them visited Tuon in her wagon daily, and descended on her when she went out for a walk. They talked of truces and treaties and negotiations, tried to learn what connection she had to the leaders of the invasion, attempted to convince her to help arrange talks to end the fighting. They even offered to help her leave the show and return home. Unfortunately for them, Tuon did not see three Aes Sedai, representatives of the White Tower, perhaps the greatest power on Earth, not even after the seamstresses began delivering their riding dresses and they could change out of the ragbag leavings Matt had been able to find for them. She saw two escaped Demani and a Marath Demani, and she had no use for either until they were decently collared. Her phrase, that. When they came to her wagon, she latched the door, and if they managed to get inside before she could, she left. When they cornered her, or tried to, she walked around them the same as walking around a stump. They all but talked themselves hoarse, and she refused to listen. Any Aes Sedai could teach a stone patience if she had reason, yet they were unaccustomed to flat being ignored. Matt could see the frustration growing, the tight eyes and tighter mouths that took longer and longer to relax, the hands gripping skirts in fists to keep them from grabbing Tuon and shaking her. It all came to a head sooner than he expected, and not at all in the way he had imagined. The night after he gave Tuon the mare, he ate his supper with her and Solusia, and with Noel and Alvar, of course. That pair managed as much time with Tuon as he did. Lopin and Nerim, as formal as if they were in a palace instead of squeezed for room to move, served a typical early spring meal, stringy mutton with peas that had been dried and turnips that had sat too long in somebody's cellar. It was too early yet for anything to be near harvesting. Still, Lopin had made a pepper sauce for the mutton, Nerim had found pine nuts for the peas. There was plenty to go around, and nothing tasted off, so it was as fine a meal as could be managed. Olver left once supper was done, having already had his games with Tuon, and Matt changed places with Solusia to play stones. Noel remained too, despite any number of telling looks, rambling on about the Seven Towers and dead Melkir, which apparently had overtopped anything in Kyrian and Sholar Bella, the City of 10,000 Bells in Arafel, and all manner of borderland wonders, strange spires made of crystal harder than steel, and a metal bowl 100 paces across set into a hillside and the like. Sometimes he interjected comments on Matt's play, that he was exposing himself on the left, that he was setting a fine trap on the right, and just when Tuon looked ready to fall into it. That sort of thing. Matt kept his mouth shut except for chatting with Tuon, though it took gritting his teeth more than once to accomplish. Tuon found Noel's natter entertaining. He was studying the board, wondering whether he might have a small chance of gaining a draw, when Jolene led Teslin and Edesina into the wagon, like Haughty on a pedestal, smooth-faced Aes Sedai to their toenails. Jolene was wearing her great serpent ring. Squeezing by Solusia, giving her very cold looks when she was slow to move aside, they arrayed themselves at the foot of the narrow table. Noel went very still, eyeing the sisters sideways, one hand beneath his coat, as if the fool thought his knives would do any good here. "There must be an end to this, High Lady," Jolene said, very pointedly ignoring Matt. She was telling, not pleading, announcing what would be because it had to be. "Your people have brought a war to these lands such as we have not seen since the War of the Hundred Years, perhaps not since the Trolloc Wars. Tarmon Gaiden is approaching, and this war must end before it comes, lest it bring disaster to the whole world. It threatens no less than that. So there will be an end to your petulance. You will carry our offer to whoever commands among you. There can be peace until you return to your own lands across the sea, or you can face the full might of the White Tower followed by every throne from the Borderlands to the Sea of Storms. The Ammerlin seat has likely summoned them against you already. I have heard of vast Borderland armies already in the south, and other armies moving.
Better to end this without more bloodshed, though. So avert your people's destruction and help bring this peace."
Matt could not see Edesina's reaction, but Teslin simply blinked. For an Aes Sedai, that was as good as a gasp. Maybe this was not exactly what she had expected Jolene to say. For his part, he groaned under his breath. Jolene was no Grey, as deft as a skilled juggler in negotiations, that was for sure, but neither was he, and he still figured she had found a short path to putting Tuon's back up. But Tuon folded her hands in her lap beneath the table and sat very straight, looking right through the Aes Sedai. Her face was as stern as it had ever been for him.
"Solusha," she said quietly.
Moving up behind Teslin, the yellow-haired woman bent long enough to take something from beneath the blanket Matt was sitting on. As she straightened, everything seemed to happen all at once. There was a click, and Teslin screamed, clapping her hands to her throat. The fox head turned to ice against Matt's chest, and Jolene's head whipped around with an incredulous stare for the red. Edesina turned and ran for the door, which swung half open, then slammed shut. Slammed against Blerick or Fenn by the sound of men falling down the wagon's steps. Edesina jerked to a halt and stood very stiffly, arms at her sides and divided skirts pressed against her legs by invisible cords. All that in moments, and Solusia had not stayed still. She bent briefly to the bed Noel was sitting on, then snapped the silver collar of another Edam around Jolene's neck. Matt could see that was what Teslin was gripping with both hands. She was not trying to take it off, just holding on to it, but her knuckles were white. The red's narrow face was an image of despair, her eyes staring and haunted. Jolene had regained the utter calm of an Aes Sedai, but she did touch the segmented collar encircling her neck.
"If you think you can—" she began, then cut off abruptly, her mouth going tight. An angry light shone in her eyes.
"You see, the Edam can be used to punish, though that is seldom done."
Tuon stood, and she had the bracelet of an Edam on each wrist, the gleaming leashes snaking away under the blankets on the beds. How in the light had she managed to get her hands on those?
"No," Matt said. "You promised not to harm my followers, Precious."
Maybe not the wisest thing to use that name now, but it was too late to call it back.
"You've kept your promises so far. Don't go back on one now."
"I promised not to cause dissension among your followers, Toy," she said snippily. "And in any case, it is very clear that these three are not your followers."
The small sliding door used to talk to whoever was driving or pass out food slid open with a loud bang. She glanced over her shoulder, and it slid shut with a louder. A man cursed outside and began beating at the door.
"The Edam can also be used to give pleasure, as a great reward," Tuon told Jolene, ignoring the hammering fist behind her.
Jolene's lips parted, and her eyes grew very wide. She swayed, and the rope-suspended table swung as she caught herself with both hands to keep from falling. If she was impressed, though, she hit it well. She did smooth her dark gray skirts once, after she was upright again, but that might have meant nothing. Her face was all Aes Sedai composure. Edesina, looking over her shoulder, matched that calm gaze, although she now wore the third Edam around her neck. And come to it, her face was paler than usual. But Teslin had begun weeping silently, shoulders shaking, tears leaking down her cheeks. Noel was tensed, a man ready to do something stupid. Matt kicked him under the table and, when the man glared at him, shook his head. Noel's scowl deepened, but he took his hand out of his coat and leaned back against the wall. Still glaring. Well, let him. Knives were no use here. But maybe words could be. Much better if this could be ended with words.
"Listen," Matt said to Tuon. "If you think, you'll see 100 reasons this won't work. Light you can learn to channel yourself. Doesn't knowing that change anything? You're not far different from them."
He might as well have turned to smoke and blown away for all the attention she paid.
"Try to embrace Sidar," she drawled, stern eyes steady on Jolene.
Her voice was quite mild in comparison to her gaze, yet plainly she expected obedience.
"Obedience?"
She looked a bloody leopard staring at three tethered goats. And strangely, more beautiful than ever. A beautiful leopard who might rake him with her claws as soon as the goats. Well, he had faced a leopard a few times before this, and those were his own memories. There was an odd sort of exhilaration that came with confronting a leopard.
"Go ahead," she went on. "You know the shield is gone."
Jolene gave a small grunt of surprise, and Tuan nodded.
"Good. You've obeyed for the first time, and learned that you cannot touch the power while you wear the Adam, unless I wish it. But now I wish you to hold the power, and you do, though you didn't try to embrace it."
Jolene's eyes widened slightly, a small crack in her calm.
"And now," Tuan went on, "I wish you not to be holding the power, and it is gone from you. Your first lessons."
Jolene drew a deep breath. She was beginning to look, not afraid, but uneasy. "Blood and bloody ashes, woman," Matt growled. "Do you think you can parade them around in those leashes without anyone noticing?" A heavy thump came from the door. A second produced the sound of cracking wood. Whoever was beating at the wooden window was still at it, too. Somehow that caused no sense of urgency. If the warders got in, what could they do?
"I will house them in the wagon they are using and exercise them at night," she snapped irritably. "I am nothing like these women, Toy. Nothing like them. Perhaps I could learn, but I choose not to, just as I choose not to steal or commit murder. That makes all the difference."
Recovering herself with visible effort, she sat down with her hands on the table, focused on the Aes Sedai once again.
"I've had considerable success with one woman like you."
Edesina gasped, murmured a name too low to be caught.
"Yes," Tuan said. "You must have met my Mylan in the kennels or at exercise. I will train you all as well as she is. You have been cursed with a dark taint, but I will teach you to have pride in the service you give the Empire."
"I didn't bring these three out of Ebu Dar so you could take them back," Matt said firmly, sliding himself along the bed. The fox head grew colder still, and Tuan made a startled sound.
"How did you do that, Toy? The weave melted when it touched you."
"It's a gift, precious." As he stood up, Seleucia started toward him, crouching, her hands outstretched and pleading. Fear painted her face.
"You must not," she began.
"No," Tuan said sharply. Seleucia straightened and backed away, though she kept her eyes on him. Strangely, the fear vanished from her expression. He shook his head in wonder. He knew the bosomy woman obeyed Tuan instantly. She was Sojin, after all, as much owned as Tuan's horse, and she actually thought that right and good. But how obedient did you need to be to lose your fear at an order?
"They have annoyed me, Toy," Tuan said as he put his hands on Teslin's collar.
Still trembling, tears still streaming down her cheeks, the red looked as though she could not believe he would actually remove the thing.
"They annoy me, too."
Placing his fingers just so, he pressed, and the collar clicked open. Teslin seized his hands and began kissing them.
"Thank you,"
she wept over and over.
"Thank you, thank you."
Matt cleared his throat.
"You're welcome, but there's no need for... Would you stop that? Teslin!"
Reclaiming his hands took some effort.
"I want them to stop annoying me, Toy," Tuan said as he turned to Jolene.
From anyone else, that might have been petulant. The dark little woman made it a demand.
"I think they'll agree to that after this," he said dryly.
But Jolene was looking up at him with a stubborn set to her jaw.
"You will agree, won't you?"
The green said nothing.
"I do agree," Teslin said quickly. "We do all agree." "Yes, we all agree,"
Edesina added. Jolene stared at him silently, stubbornly, and Matt sighed.
"I could let Precious keep you for a few days until you change your mind."
Jolene's collar clicked open in his hands.
"But I won't.
Still staring into his eyes, she touched her throat as though to confirm the collar was gone.
"Would you like to be one of my warders?" she asked, then laughed softly. "No need to look like that. Even if I would bond you against your will, I couldn't so long as you have that Tirangriol." "I agree, Master Cawthon. It may cost our best chance to stop the Seanchan, but I will no longer bother. Precious."
Tuon hissed like a doused cat, and he sighed again.
"What you gained on the swings, you lost on the roundabouts."
He spent part of that night doing what he liked least in the world. Working. Digging a deep hole to bury the three Adam. He did the job himself because, surprisingly, Jolene wanted them. They were Tirangriol, after all, and the White Tower needed to study them. That might well have been so, but the Tower would just have to find their Adam elsewhere. He was fairly certain that none of the Red Arms would have handed them over if he'd told them to bury the things, yet he was taking no chances that they would reappear to cause more trouble. It started raining before the hole was knee-deep. A cold, driving rain, and by the time he was done, he was soaked to the skin and mud to his waist. A fine end to a fine night, with the dice bouncing around his skull.